Okay, questions? Class?
Trying to figure out what how you calculate A, or how you figure out A from looking at these. So it took me a while to figure out, you know, how to look at, there we go, how to look at it on this plot. And because when you had been doing it on the board, it was not a plot of versus K, it was a plot of R. And then there was like slope, but this.
No, mostly it's been plots with respect to K.
Well, the specific ones I remember you talking about how to figure out A from looking at this, but like this was a plot of.
Yep, that's a plot.
And so it's like, okay, you look at the slope over here, but I figured out that the important region is here. Is at the origin because when K is zero, it's because it's low energy.
Yep.
So I don't remember how to figure it out after that.
Well, it's pretty easy, and I can't believe it's not going to be in here someplace.
It may have been so easy that I didn't write it down.
Well, let's see. You have it in a complicated way.
Oh, that's always the best.
So that was this partial wave expansion. So it's hidden in there, but it's not so easily. Yeah, so maybe you didn't write it down. So here was a Taylor series expansion of cotangent of delta. Mm-hmm. And if you just do a Taylor series expansion of delta by itself, then it's equal to minus AL, well, plus some number of pi's, right?
Okay. Okay.
So all you have to do is look at the slope.
Yeah. Okay, so it's still looking at the slope.
Yep, and you can kind of see how these
would be a positive.
That would be a positive one because it has a negative slope, and this minus sign really is there.
Yep. And then this one would be a negative one.
That would be a negative one.
Okay. And I'm not clear on the problem, so I'm not going to ask a further question on that. But I think you asked us to go through this entire packet.
Yes.
And do you want us to do it for, like, I suppose it's only looking at the...
It's only delta zero.
Delta zero. So.
Yep.
Okay, yeah, that's, I understand that then.
Other questions? Okay, so last time we had some kind of introductory stuff, complex variable integration. You can reduce loop integrals on the complex plane to a sum of residues. Green's functions are basically where we're solving differential equations where the right-hand side is a delta function. And we used complex integration to show that the Green's function for the Helmholtz equation was given by that. And it's kind of no surprise because if k equals zero, this was just the Laplace equation, and we had shown in E&M that the Green's function for that was just a point charge. So if we apply that to Schrodinger's equation, we showed that this was solution. It's not a, doesn't seem to be real helpful because it doesn't say psi equals. It says psi equals something in terms of psi. So we needed, it's perfectly correct, but we needed some sort of approximation. And what we said is that maybe the wave function inside the potential isn't much changed from what it is normally. So if it starts out with some wave vector k initial, if we put that in here and assume that it's the same thing inside the potential, we end up with this formula for the scattering amplitude. And this difference in the initial value of k and the final value of k is being called q. I do note that if you look at other places, they're going to define q to be the other way around, and it certainly makes more sense to talk about momentum transfer if it's k final minus k initial. So I have no idea why Griffiths has decided to define it that way. It makes no important difference because in the end, the Fourier transform just depends on the magnitude of q. So you can define it as plus q or minus q and you're going to get the same answer. So for us, elastic scattering, the final wave vector has the same magnitude as the initial k vector. And so this is just an isosceles triangle, and we can get that the magnitude of q is 2k times the sine of theta over 2. So I do note that this is easy to calculate when k goes to 0. If k is 0, then we just have the volume integral of the potential. And for the square well potentials we've been talking about, that's just going to be minus V naught times the volume of the bubble. And it's pretty much totally incorrect. It doesn't show scattering length sorts of phenomena where the cross section depends sensitively on the details of the potential, doesn't show resonances, doesn't satisfy the optical theorem. And in some sense, that's kind of no surprise. At low energies, the wave function, particularly in resonance, is going to be hugely modified from the original wave function. So the situation where this would be the case is if the potential is small change, right? Whether if the potential being there or not doesn't make much difference, then we're typically at a high energy situation. So Born approximation is going to be mostly valid at high energies. I do notice that we can iterate it, right? We can take this formula for psi and we can plug it in there for psi. And then we can take that thing and plug it in again. So we can get a whole series, an infinite series of presumably better and better approximations to the wave function. And the book relates this to Feynman diagrams. Questions? So what we've got is, with partial waves, it's kind of a mess, particularly at high energy. We got more and more waves to sum. Finding the phase shifts for any particular energy is kind of a mess. Here, all we need to do is to find the Fourier transform of the potential, and we're good to go. But, I don't know. We're often very interested in high energy behavior, too. So, it's a pretty good deal. Questions. So one of the homework problems relates, shows you that the partial wave expansion, which is fully correct, agrees with this sort of method, kind of, when we have large values of initial momentum. Okay, so the direction we're going to be going is form factors. And form factors are crop up in lots of places under various names. And the upshot is that under lots of circumstances, what we are interested in is itself the Fourier. What we can measure is the Fourier transform of what we're interested in. And we'll see this in the particular application of figuring out the size of nucleus. And in particular, the density of the nucleons as a function of R. But pretty much the same thing applies, for example, for determining the shape of crystals, right? X-ray crystallography. Pretty much identical sort of idea. What we can measure is basically the Fourier transform of the electron charge distribution in the unit cell. And by getting better and better values of the Fourier transform, we can figure out what the electron distribution is, and they can figure out what the shape of the protein is that's filling the unit cell. Okay, so the main thing we're going to need here is a statement about convolutions. And it's going to seem, I guess, pretty abstract. Let's see what notation I used for it. But you'll see it in action. Okay, so what I called this thing is h of x. And it's going to be the convolution and what we're going to be interested in is we're going to relate the Fourier transform of lowercase h to the Fourier transform of f and the Fourier transform of g. So first of all, where is kind of an example of where you would use these sorts of convolutions practically? And this would typically be, for y going to plus minus infinity. So imagine that you are collecting data, might be voltages, who knows what it is. And you think that there's some high frequency noise in it that you're trying to get rid of. So one thing you might do is you might make what would usually be called a moving average. So you might average all of these things that are in this box and then average all the things that are in this box and basically take a moving average of your data. Right? You might think that that would eliminate the high frequency noise. Mathematically, what you're doing is taking a convolution. You're taking a convolution where this G is these things are sometimes called boxcars, is the region of space where you're going to be averaging things. And so when F is within Y, where Y has, this G has some support, some range in which it's non-zero, when we're looking at the values of F that are within that region, we're just taking the average of those guys. Okay, so convolutions like this are pretty useful, moderately common in various types of data analysis. And actually, in digital that a lot of you are taking, we'll talk some about how to make these sorts of digital filters by convolution. So you might guess that you can do better than just taking a boxcar average of the results. You can fine-tune G to give you more precisely what you want. Okay, so that's the context. If we have a convolution, how does the Fourier transform of the convoluted variable relate to the Fourier transforms of the things that went into it? And the result is going to be pretty simple. So if we take the Fourier transform of this, and so here's another, kind of difference between Griffiths and the rest of the world, I guess. You know that Fourier transforms and inverse Fourier transforms look very, very similar, right? It's kind of whether you have a plus k or a minus k in there. And typically, when people are taking Fourier transforms of this, they'd be using e to the minus ik. Right, that would be the Fourier transform of it. And I'm going to go with that, but you can see that Griffiths is kind of using the other possibility. And in the end, it doesn't matter. You can map k to minus k. And I guess I sure wish Griffith had done things normally because it makes formula look different even if they're not different. And you might know that the two pi's are kind of negotiable. You can put the two pi's lots of different places, and I'm going to put them in the easiest possible place, which is not visible. Okay, so this quantity here is exactly what I mean by the Fourier transform, and x is being integrated over, so in the end this thing is just a function of whatever I've put in for k. And if I put in the formula for h, so h is the integral from minus infinity f of x minus y g of y dy, and I still have my integral of dx. And the plan is, I don't know, kind of useful, obvious. I'm going to convert that to a y minus x. And of course, that's going to require me to put a corresponding term there. So now, what I've got from these terms is exactly the Fourier transform of f, right? Because I could just do a change of variable, call x minus yu, du is equal to dx. So this is exactly the Fourier transform of f. And what's left over is exactly the Fourier transform of, is exactly the Fourier transform of g. Right, so the upshot then is that for a convolution, Fourier transform of the convolved quantity is just the product of the Fourier transforms of the two things that are convolved. Okay, so how does this relate to my example? If g looks kind of like that, what does the Fourier transform of it look like? Can you do Fourier transforms in your head? Apparently not, huh? So yeah, I think I'm going to say no. It might be, but I think that's not a helpful statement. So what is the Fourier transform of a delta function? And this is kind of a delta function. I think so, yep. So if we just do the Fourier transform, right? So this would be the integral of e to the minus I kx delta of x integrated with respect to x. So that would give me this thing evaluated at x equals 0 and e to the 0. So the Fourier transform of a delta function is a constant. It's a sum of all possible wavelengths, frequencies, whatever you want to talk about. And you can kind of see how that works so this in general, so let me bring this back to G. In general, what we're going to have here is some wave that we're going to multiply by G of X. If the wavelength is very long, we're basically just going to get the value of cosine at that spot. So the Fourier transform of g is going to be constant until we start getting multiple waves inside that region, in which case it's going to start to cancel. Right? So when k is comparable to 1 over delta, that's when this thing is going to start to decline. And at very, very high wavelengths, very, very high frequency, whatever you want to talk about, it's going to average out to 0. Are people believing that? Matt, are you believing that? Okay. And you can see then how this works, right? If f had some, so now this is going to be a graph of the Fourier transform of f. If f had some high frequency components, when we multiply these two together, we're going to kill those high frequency components. And so the Fourier transform of h is just going to have the low frequency behavior that maybe we want. Okay, so convolutions, not uncommon ways of analyzing data, and they have this important property. Okay, well, how does this relate to the problem at hand? Well, if you think about it, the electrostatic potential is a convolution. So if we're going to calculate the voltage of some charge distribution, we're going to have 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught add up the charge at some location r prime and divide it by r minus r prime. And that's a convolution. Right? So here is my function that is a function of x minus y. Here's my g of y. I'm integrating everything up. Okay. Well, remember we said that the scattering amplitude was just the Fourier transform of the potential. And now we see that if we're thinking about the potential inside of a nucleus, the electrostatic potential inside of a nucleus, it's just the convolution of 1 over r with the charge distribution. Okay, so far so good. So the rabbit comes out of the hat pretty suddenly. What this means is that if we do all of this stuff, the F that we're going to get is the F of Rutherford scattering. Right? So that's Rutherford scattering is going to relate to the Fourier transform of just 1 over R times the Fourier transform of the charge distribution. And therefore, the differential scattering cross-section is going to be the differential scattering cross-section of Rutherford scattering times the magnitude of the Fourier transform of the charge distribution squared. Okay, so the rabbit came out of the hat maybe pretty quick. The scattering amplitude is the Fourier transform of the potential. The potential is the convolution of a point charge with the charge distribution. Convolutions theory tells us that the Fourier transform of this potential is going to be the Fourier transform of a point charge, and the Fourier transform of a point charge is going to give us Rutherford scattering times the Fourier transform of the density. So there we've got it. We can figure out the Fourier the magnitude of the Fourier transform of the charge distribution inside of a nucleus by looking at the ratio of the measured differential scattering cross-section to what you would calculate from Rutherford scattering. Okay? And these things are called form factors. So here's kind of real data. So this is showing the differential scattering cross-section of something. And the main point I'm showing you here is, of course, at small angles, the differential scattering cross-section gets huge, right? 1 over theta to the fourth, that's Rutherford scattering. If we divide out Rutherford scattering from this thing, we get things that don't vary quite so much. They still are getting small. And we have these curves over on the right-hand side. I think this one is for oxygen and this one's for carbon. We can get pretty quickly a ballpark estimate for the size of the nucleus by looking at this. So this central peak for small angles, and small angles corresponds to small q, right? So this is q. So what we expect then is the Fourier transform is going to start to get small when we have lots of waves that we are interact. So just like this thing here, we expected that this thing was going to be more or less constant until the magnitude of k times the size, I called it delta there, was about equal to 1. So this is k, so when 2k, this is q, when 2k sine theta over 2 is comparable to the size of this nuclei, that's where we're going to start to get this sharp decline. Oops, times r is approximately 1. Okay, so roughly speaking, what's the size of this nucleus? This one here. Pretty much the same thing for carbon. Well, we get that sharp decline when this quantity is about 0.3 GeV. Which is 300 MeV. Well, so you might be wondering about our units. K should have the units of inverse length, not the units of energy. Why is it being given the units of energy? Well, it's basically a relationship between H bar C. Right, so you know that the energy, for example, of a photon is going to be hc divided by lambda, which is h bar c k. So if we take these energies and divide them by h bar c, we get k. And h bar c has the memorable value of 197 MeV Fermis, where a Fermi is 10 to the minus 15th meters. So roughly speaking, the radius of this thing is going to be 300 over 200 Fermis. One and a half Fermis. We can do a whole lot better by actually doing the real Fourier transform. And that's what these solid curves do. So by making a kind of guesstimate about the charge distribution, and here are some examples down here. These examples are actually for a bigger nucleus, gold. By making some sort of approximation, we can then fit these precise dips that we see in the data. Okay, so if you can do it for gold and you can do it for carbon and oxygen, you can do it for a single proton. And this is the form factor for a single proton. Again, expressed in terms of energy. So from that data, we can figure out what the physical size is of a proton. What's the radius of a proton? This formula here is sometimes confusingly called the dipole formula, and it has nothing to do with electrical dipoles. It has to do with the fact that this is, these things here are called poles, and this is two of them, right? Because it's inverse squared. So don't be confused by the fact that the proton has a dipole form factor. It has nothing to do with the electrical dipole. It's just talking about the Fourier transform of the charge distribution. Okay, so if we want to do a great job of figuring out what the charge distribution is inside of a nucleus, we're going to want to be putting in some sort of guesstimate for the charge distribution and figuring out what the Fourier transform is it and making it so that it fits the data as good as possible. It might be worth commenting that why is this done with model building as opposed to direct Fourier transform? Right? If we know what the Fourier transform is, why don't we just apply the inverse Fourier transform and get directly measured values of the charge distribution as opposed to these modeled values? And the problem is one of phase. We don't know what the Fourier transform is. What we know is what the magnitude of the Fourier transform is. So the absence of phase data makes taking the inverse Fourier transform of it very problematic. This is a pretty common problem. So I think I said that I was going to talk about this in the context of figuring out the structure of nuclei. You could just as well be doing this by figuring out the structure of crystals, proteins in a crystalline array, where there, instead of having, this data was typically collected by sending high-speed electrons at a nucleus. In the case of X-ray scattering, it's X-rays, right? So you send X-rays at your crystal and look at the scattering. And what you get is basically the Fourier transform of the charge distribution. And what you want is the actual charge distribution. And because you don't have the phase data, you can't just take your raw data and put it into a computer and get out the actual charge distribution. You have to do some sort of modeling and then see if your model gives you the magnitude of the Fourier transform that you've actually measured. Okay, so we were kind of doing crude modeling when we were saying that k times r needed to be about 1 in order to be seeing the edge of the charge distribution. Can we do a little bit better? So f of k is the Fourier transform of the charge distribution. And I remind you that experimentally, this k value is 2 times the actual k times the sine of the half angle that the stuff came off at. Okay. Well, let's do a little bit better. Let's look at the values of basically Taylor expand the Fourier transform. Okay, so if we're looking for small values of k, we can approximate this exponential as 1 minus I k times r I guess it's going to be a minus because we're going to have an I squared of k dot r squared over 2 factorial and lots of higher order terms. So this term here, which corresponds to the value of f of 0, is just going to be the total charge. Which is usually called z, right? Well, z times e. But typically people divide out the z, so we want to normalize this thing to 1. So the charge distribution is going to, instead of having the total charge, this, the thing that I've denoted by rho is going to be the fraction of the charge, the charge density divided by the total charge. Okay, well, how about the next order term? So the next order term is kind of like the center of mass, right? Charge density times position. And the center of mass is going to be right in the center, right? So this term has to give us 0. About the next order term. Well, the next order term is kind of like the moment of inertia. Let's take a look at what it is exactly. So what we have here is minus 1/2, and then we've got the integral of k dot r squared charge density d cubed r. And of course, k dot r by itself is the sum of ki ri, where ri are the Cartesian components of r. And we have that thing squared, so we're going to have this thing times itself. And it's helpful not to use the same variable in the sum. So I'm going to call this the sum of kj rj. So in order to evaluate this integral, what I need to do is to have, for example, the integral of x times y, the charge density times the volume. Well, what's that integral? What's the integral of x times y times the charge density? Say again?
The charge distribution.
Well, I guess I would say rho is the charge distribution. Rho is the charge density at any location.
Oh,
so in mechanics, things like this had names, like I forget what the off-diagonal elements of the moment of inertia tensor are called, but that's what this is. Well, guys are taking mechanics. What are the off-diagonal components of a spherically symmetric charge distribution?
Zero.
Zero, right? I can't ask that question unless the answer is pretty similar, pretty simple. So x by itself is an, if I do just the x integral, it's going to be an odd integrand integrated over an even interval, right? So these things, all of the ij's are going to give us 0. So I'm pretty quickly going to be interested in this. But if this is a spherically symmetric charge distribution, it has to be the same no matter what variable I take. So whatever this is, it better be a third of the integral of r squared rho dr. And I would call this the average value of r squared. So what we've got is that f of k, Taylor series expanded, it starts at 1, and it's going to be minus 1 half times 1 third times the average value of r squared times k squared. So just by looking at the small k behavior of the Fourier transform of the charge distribution, I can immediately get out what the RMS value is of the radius of the object. So one of your homework problems is to take this dipole Fourier transform of the charge distribution of a proton and figure out what the RMS radius is of a proton. Incidentally, the RMS radius of a proton has been in dispute recently. So you can read about 7 sigma deviations between various measurements of it. And I guess I wouldn't be highly worried about that. People can make pretty high precision measurements of these things that have systematic errors in them that they don't understand. But so even though it's 7 sigma off, disagreement between those, it's what that really means is that they know it to 6 significant digits. Not that there's a great dispute about the radius of the proton. So different measurements of ways of measuring the radius of the proton include muonic atoms, right? So the electron doesn't spend a lot of time in the hydrogen atom inside the proton. It's the density, the likelihood of it being there is highest per volume of any other spot, but it's such a small volume that it doesn't spend a lot of time there. If you use a muonic atom, that is to say, replace the electron with a muon, and you can do that for about 10 to the minus 6 seconds before the muon decays, replace the electron with a muon, then it, because the radius of the orbits is proportional to the mass, the radius of the orbits is now 1/100 the size of the Bohr radius, and now the muon spends a pretty large amount of time inside the nucleus. And so the change in the energy levels due to the fact that the muon is spending a noticeable fraction of its time inside the nucleus is quite measurable, and it provides another way of measuring the radius of the of a proton or any nucleus. As I say, currently they're in disagreement, but they're agreeing about lots of significant digits. Might also briefly comment about the result for nuclear densities. I'm sure you talked about this in modern physics, but I'll remind you. So the upshot is that this density that we have in the core of a nucleus is pretty constant across lots of different nuclei. So the picture we have is that at the core of the nucleus, the nucleons, the neutrons and protons, are packed cheek to jowl. At some kind of maximum possible density. And as we go towards the edge, there's kind of an exponential tail off of the charge density as we move away. And since they have pretty much the same packing, that means that the radius of a nucleus should be proportional to the cube root of the total number of particles that are in the nucleus. And that's famous formula that about 1.1 a to the 1/3 Fermi is the typical size of a nucleus. Probably more information than you need is to comment that not all nuclei are spherically symmetric. So there are ellipsoidal, and in fact, nuclei that have 3 different moments of inertia have no rotational symmetry axis whatsoever. And all that you can figure out by looking at the Fourier transform of the charge distribution. Most nuclei, 90% of nuclei, are spherical. Okay, so let's practice our Fourier transforms and take a look at what the Fourier transform would be for this case that we talked about earlier, where the charge distribution is uniform up to some radius. what should we expect, approximately speaking, for the Fourier transform under such circumstance? So Fourier transform, the form factor, is the integral of e to the minus I k dot r. And we're going to deal with something that has a charge distribution that goes to zero at some radius r. And therefore, the value for the charge density is just 1 over the volume, right? So it's going to be 3 over 4 pi r cubed. But it's only going to exist inside the radius r. Then we have our volume integral, which is r squared dr d cosine theta d phi. Okay, well, nothing. So in order to do this integral, we have to choose some r-axis. And we might as well choose our r-axis to be aligned with whatever direction k happens to be pointing at this moment. So this is just going to be k times r times the cosine of the angle between k times between r and k. And so nothing depends on phi. So we can do the phi integral and just get 2 pi. The cosine integral is now easy, right? The antiderivative of this is going to be 1 over I minus I kr. And then we're going to have e to the minus I krc evaluated between minus 1 and 1. So what we've got is e to the I kr minus e to the minus I kr over I kr. And if I put in a 2 here, better put a balancing 2 there, then what I've got is sine. Okay, so what I've got then is f of k, this constant, 3 over 4 pi r cubed, this constant, this r is going to cancel out one of those r's. If I want to put this in standard form, it would be nice to multiply by a couple of k's so I can do a change of variable. So what I've got here then is the integral from 0 to kr of sine of u du. And that one can look up in an integral table. Dwight 43011. And the answer is sine of u minus u times the cosine of u. Okay, so what we've got then for our final answer, oops, so these two pi's I dropped, right? So these four pi's are going to disappear then. And we've got k cubed r cubed there. So what we're going to get is 3 over kr cubed sine of kr minus kr times the cosine of kr. Well, remember that I said that for small values of k, this thing is supposed to equal 1 minus 1/6 of k squared times the average r squared. Is that true? How can we get the average value of r squared from this formula? Okay, so what we've got, let me kind of rewrite it in terms of u, just because it'll take less time. So I've got 3 over u cubed sine of u. In fact, actually, let me bring one of those u's inside. Okay, so now it's time to remember our Taylor series expansions. What's the Taylor series expansion of cosine? Better start at 1, because cosine of 0 is 1. Yeah, with divided by the factorial terms. Sine by itself would start at u, but it's divided by u, so this is going to be 1 minus u squared divided by 3 factorial, having lost one factor of u. So the ones are going to cancel, and we're going to have 1 half minus a third times u squared. Am I going to be happy with this result? So 1 half minus a third is a sixth. Yes, thank you. 3 factorial is a sixth. So now it's a third, which I like a lot better. And so we've got u squared, 3, 3. So at small values of u, this thing goes to 1, right? All of those negative terms in the denominator sure make it look like it's not going to have a finite value when u goes to 0. But you can see that it did. Okay, so this wants to be u to the fifth, but it's going to be fourth, divided by 5 factorial. So what's this term going to be? So we have plus 1 over 5 factorial minus 1 over 4 factorial, all times 3, and then times u squared, right? So that's looking good, right? We expected a k squared. What's all of this garbage going to be? Well, let's pull out a 4 factorial from this. Yeah, let's pull out a 4 factorial. So this is 3 over 4 factorial, 1 fifth minus 1. And that's minus 4 fifths. So the 4 factorial is going to be knocked down to 3 factorial. We have a minus sign, and we've got a 5. And the 3 is going to knock that down, so this is going to be minus a tenth. So what we've got is 1 minus a tenth of kr, that's what u is, squared. Well, we could figure out what the average value is of r squared. Does it give us the right answer? Well, let me real quickly calculate the average value of r squared. It's not too hard. That's going to be the integral of r to the fourth, 4 pi dr divided by the integral of r squared, 4 pi dr, out to some radius r. Can you kind of see that quickly? R squared 4 pi dr is the volume element, so here I have the extra value of r squared. So this is going to be 1 fifth divided by 1 third. So 3 fifths r squared is the RMS value of it. So if I put in 3 fifths, do I get a tenth? Yes, I do, right? A sixth of 3 fifths is a tenth. So everything has worked out for the best. Okay, so last class, do class evaluations. Bring your computer or go downstairs and use a computer there.